You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Ilya.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Actually, the truth is you have a cold, but it's very nice of you not to mention that to the larger viewing audience.
It's true. But I try not to think about it. I'm figuring mind over matter in this case, you know.
Yeah. That's my philosophy. It's never worked, but that's my philosophy. So let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter, and this is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Ilya Delio, a professor of theology at Villanova University and also a sister in the Franciscan order. Pope Francis, I guess, chose the name Francis by way of kind of embracing the values of the Franciscan order. Is that the idea?
Actually, he embraced the values of Francis of Assisi in particular.
Right.
In 1979, Pope John Paul II named Francis of Assisi the patron saint of ecology. So It was a good name for Pope Francis, who really has brought to light the whole environmental agenda, certainly in the Catholic community, and the need for interconnectedness. And I think we all realize that wherever we are now today on this planet, and environmental sustainability. Changing our lives.
Aren't the Franciscans also known for kind of concern for the downtrodden and a particular emphasis on that?
We're very earthy people. We're all about the earth and people. Earth and people. Those are our two main foci.
Two of my favorite
animals.
Yeah. Three of my favorite things.
Very good.
So you are a leading authority on somebody named Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who came up with the term, we think, we can talk about this, but I'm pretty sure he is the one who came up with the term noosphere or newosphere. We can talk about the pronunciation for that matter, and did a lot to formulate, our conception of it. And it's a term that, although coined in a theological context, was also coined in a scientific context. He was both a Jesuit priest and a paleologist of some note, actually. Paleontologist, thank you. You can correct me as often as is necessary. That won't be the last time. It's a term, noosphere has acquired a second life in a certain sense, I think, as a result of the blossoming of the digital age, the internet, and so on. We'll talk about why that is. It's N-O-O-S-P-H-E-R-E, by the way, for those not familiar with it. He called it various things, including, the thinking envelope of the earth. He sometimes used the idea of a global brain to convey the idea. And so the term has kind of come back into currency, including in Silicon Valley.
Yes.
And in fact, I met you, I guess a few months ago, at a conference that was not in Silicon Valley. It was in Berkeley, but it had a little bit of a Silicon Valley vibe. And it was on the 100th anniversary of the coining of the term noosphere, and was about the various dimensions of the concept, many of which are secular. And you gave a great talk about Teilhard and his thought. And so I wanted to just have you on and talk about all this stuff. I should add, I have a particular interest. I've written about Teilhard in the past. I think it's interesting to frame artificial intelligence in the context of the noosphere. I've written a thing about that for my newsletter, the Non-Zero Newsletter, written two pieces, actually. So we're going to get into all this. First, let me ask you, what'd you think of the conference? Was it about what you expected in terms of the range of interests and how people are thinking about the noosphere, or what?
Actually, I was delightfully surprised at this conference. Yeah. I thought it was a great gathering of scientists and people in the humanities, whether it's spirituality, religion, art. It's the first time I think I saw science, including the biological sciences, information sciences, artificial intelligence, really coming into a more robust dialogue with the wider community and culture, which is exactly the type of gatherings we need now to go forth, I think, fruitfully into the future. So I was thrilled to see Teilhard's Noosphere brought into this new, much broader conversation. And I think Teilhard himself would have been absolutely delighted with the N2 conference, quite honestly. Yeah.
Well, that says something, because you're very familiar with his life and thought. Yeah, so it was called N2, just the letter N and the digit 2, the conference, and was sponsored largely by a group called Human Energy, nonprofit, that is big on the idea. Why don't we start at the beginning, I guess. There are actually two people associated prominently with the term noosphere. The other is a Russian thinker named Vernadsky. In fact, sometimes he's given credit with coining the term. Now he did do as much as anyone to popularize the term biosphere. He's a very serious and important scientist. He's a geochemist. And he wrote the big book on the biosphere in the 19th century, I gather, even though he didn't coin that term. But he saw there being three stages: geosphere, biosphere, noosphere. Have you looked much at his work, at his conception of the noosphere?
Well, funny that you mention him, because I just came across a paper by Vladimir Verdensky, and in it, he actually, according to the author of this paper, Verdansky met Teilhard de Chardin back like 1920 or so, and was influenced by his use of the term noosphere. So according to this article I had, Verdansky picked up the term noosphere from Teilhard de Chardin, and not the other way around. But you're right, they're thinking along parallel tracks, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
No, and
really interesting.
He
seeing the kind of emergence of mind on this biosphere level, you know, the biosphere moving into this higher level of mind.
Yeah. Now, I think in many ways their actual specific conceptions of it wound up differing of the noosphere in some important ways. It was something I became more aware of as a result of the conference we attended. But they were both big boosters of it, and probably the two leading, the two main reasons that we know about the term. Now, Teilhard de Chardin, maybe we should say a little bit about him. The church was not enthusiastic about some of his ideas, and as a result, a certain amount of his writing was not published until after he died in, I think, 1957. Something like that.
1955.
Oh, he died in 55. Yes. So The Phenomenon of Man, his big book, was published in 57. And then in English, that was in French, I guess. He was French.
59. Mm-hmm.
And English in 59. What didn't the church like about his ideas?
Well, Teilhard ran into trouble sort of early on when he wrote a small note on original sin, and saying that the doctrine of original sin was incompatible with biological evolution, with what we now know from biology. And he gave his reasons not to support, why my monogenism also is not a tenable doctrine or belief in light of modern biology.
And that refers now, to what
Go ahead. In this sense, that there was an original creation that was fallen due to an act of disobedience and this type thing. And, you know, many people have even contested the idea. But the fact is, Teilhard just wrote this note. He didn't anticipate that it would be published. It was reported to the Vatican or to his Jesuit superiors, which in turn got to the, you know, got into the Vatican's hands. And he was basically silenced because of those views. And then, you know, once you take out the pin of original sin, it's like dominoes, you know, it's like once you pull out the domino, everything else begins to fall. So our understanding of redemption falls because mm-hmm. Christ doesn't come to save us since we don't need to be saved anymore. And, you know, where we're going, you know, are we going to be redeemed? So all these doctrines that were built in a sense in this kind of framework pattern all fitting together nicely over the fact that God made this wonderful, beautiful creation. And then it was fallen due to a woman, basically, that would be Eve. And then she tempted poor Adam, that poor guy.
You know, we're always the victims, I'll tell you. If it weren't for women, men would be great.
Well, there you go, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, right, then it all fell down. And, you know, so Teilhard's like, look, Christianity is great. You know, in principle, it has a lot of principles that are actually compatible with evolution. I mean, one of them being this kind of hybridization between divinity and humanity, meaning that there's a depth dimension, you know, to evolution. Second, that there seems to be a direction in evolution, something that I think biologists, you know, did not accept for many, many years. And that was the one thing at the N2 conference that, you know, really, I think, rose to prominence, that there's something going on here. And that's the new sphere is this kind of new level of mind, this emergent level of mind. And so I think it's caused scientists to reconsider, well, is there direction in evolution? That's a huge question. Mm-hmm. Even if you just leave religion aside, you know, is there something going on here? That yeah, is, and first of all, we have to, it's not static. You know, things are not staying the same. So, and the second thing is that complexity, I think, has become the fourth law of evolution. There's something of the law of complexity or complexification that, you know, again, people like Francis Heiligen and others are saying that this is fundamental now to the way evolution is going, which is a very interesting phenomenon. And so all of these things led Teilhard to say, yeah, something's going on here, but it's not, you know, it's not original sin. It's something mm-hmm. else.
Yeah, the I on the issue of direction, I think there are a number of, you know, highly respected evolutionary biologists. I know a couple who are somewhat recently deceased, but very prominent, William Hamilton and E.O. Wilson, who, you know, they were just Darwinians in terms of how they conceived of evolution working, natural selection. They're not talking about any kind of mystical supporting force, but they did think the evolution of great, more and more complex organisms was this highly likely outcome of evolution. In fact, both of them, I think, certainly Hamilton thought that the evolution of some species as intelligent as humans was very likely. And the reason that's important is because it takes a species like that to launch some kind of technological or more broadly cultural evolution that has led to this thing that increasingly looks like a noosphere, an interconnected global, you know, kind of infrastructure for human thought. I mean, not that the infrastructure per se is the noosphere as Teilhard would have conceived it, but it's more like the thought coursing through it. But that part is a respectable thing to say, even though there are also biologists who think that intelligent life wasn't a likely outcome.
I could see, you know, I could see an argument from evolutionary biology saying that, yeah, things become more complex because actually greater complexity is more resilience. So there's a greater chance of survivability and adaptability if you're like, you know, it's like strength in numbers idea, you know, like you're more together than you are individually. So I think just in terms of survival of the fittest, density actually is an advantage. You know, in evolution. I think the one thing here that we have to really consider, because this conversation on complexity and evolution really ties into the question of artificial intelligence. Like there's something here. And the question is not so much adaptability and survivability, it's about transcendence. It's not so much that we want to survive. It's actually that we want to go beyond ourselves. So that's the very interesting question here.
You mean
that I think
for Teilhard it was?
Yeah. For Teilhard, and I think just in a broader sense, we haven't really, if you look at artificial intelligence, I mean, even if you look at it culturally, like through the various films that have been, you know, made over the last 10, 15 years, there's a dynamic there of wanting to go beyond. The whole transhumanist movement is about the moreness or beyondness. Like we can become super smart, super, you know, super healthy, super wealthy, super nice. And so that super, you know, that moreness really speaks to, there's a dynamic within evolution for beyond, for the beyondness of what we already are. And I think that's different. That's a different trajectory than the kind of complexification. It's related to complexification, but complexification and sort of like, let's work together because, you know, we can, in a sense, accomplish more as a symbiotic system than individually. But there's something even beyond that, saying that it's not just adaptability as a system, it's going beyond that system. We want to become more than just the system. And that's what's very interesting. That then becomes a Teilhardian question as well. And I think that's the question of direction for Teilhard. Mm-hmm. It's not so much, much like, oh, God's waiting for us at the end, you know, idea. It is that there's a transcendent nature to nature. I think it's what drives artificial intelligence. Like, why do we keep making like smaller chips, faster chips? We want to be, become more perfect. You know, the idea of perfectibility, that there's something within us that constantly wants to perfect what we are. So we're never happy or we're never satisfied being, okay, here we are. You know, we can call one another, text one another. Let's leave it at this. No way, Jose, right? We want to definitely go beyond what we are now. And that's we have an infinite drive for transcendence. That becomes then not only a scientific question, it actually becomes a religious question as well.
Yeah, there's a lot there. And you're saying that Teilhard would emphasize that, I gather, the transcendence.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so in his, well, let's back up a little. One thing he did that I think is notable. See, the thing about him is I think even the purely secular version of him has a lot of a growing amount of appeal. In other words, he kind of got the big picture sooner than some, certainly in this sense. I mean, he talks about, you know, he's even talking about the importance of computers long before, you know, most people had heard of them. But the whole idea of a blossoming global brain, I mean, not that many people were talking about that back when he was talking about that. But another thing he got that I think has come to the fore more in, I don't know, in some kind of intersection of biology and philosophy, is that is the connection between biological complexity and consciousness. Now, he would actually paint more broadly and say that it's a connection between complexity, even of a non-biological sort of consciousness. I mean, if we have time, we can get into the question of how close he was to being so-called panpsychist who thinks that, you know, there's some degree of consciousness in everything. And then the more complex structures kind of have more of it. But certainly if you confine yourself just to evolution, I mean, one thing I learned from your talk is I think you said he actually plotted a graph of complexity and consciousness. And just to make the point that as complexity has grown through evolution, consciousness has grown, by which we just mean subjective experience, the richness of subjective experience, and the really just remarkable fact that it's like something to be alive, which to this day, I don't think any philosopher or scientist truly has a fully adequate fix on, a fully adequate explanation for. You know, some people say they do, and I've had almost all of them on the podcast, or at least representatives of these schools on the podcast, and I remain unconvinced that we really know what's going on there. But in any event, it's what gives life meaning, right? The fact that it's like something to be alive. We have pleasure and pain and joy and love and so on. And he kind of depicted evolution as a machine or generating more of that kind of meaning. And
yeah,
right.
He tells us, evolution, he says, is really about thought. He begins with the human phenomenon, right? We are able to think, to know. And he traces that back to, in a sense, the beginning, insofar as we can talk about some kind of emergence of biological life. So for him, evolution is the rise of thought. Mm-hmm. And it's the rise of consciousness. And consciousness, just as you point out, with scientists, you're right, scientists are and philosophers are really quite spread out over this question of what is consciousness, what is the relationship of consciousness to complexity. But I think more and more, and I think here's where I think biology needs to be in touch with quantum physics. So I'm very interested in the area of quantum biology, for example, undergirding our biological life systems is this, lower level, this fundamental level of quantum reality. So, Teilhard was in dialogue with some of the leading physicists of his day back in the early part of the century. And he was really fascinated by physics, actually. And he did adopt what some might call today a dual aspect monism, a type of panpsychism where mind is part of material reality. And he called it, we might say the inside of material reality. And so he didn't think that there's inner matter that eventually gives rise to mind. So mind for him is not an epiphenomenon. It's actually an integral phenomenon of nature itself.
Right.
And that's what changes the whole scheme here for Teilhard. I mean, most bracketing modern science, I mean, in terms of religion, most religion, especially if I take Christianity, mind has not been part of materiality. It's something that we participate in, if it's the mind of God or something like that. But, to speak about mind and matter as two aspects of the same reality, that's a shift. That's a fundamental shift. But Teilhard does make that move. And he says, that's what physical evolution is, the rise of mind. It's the rise of thought.
Right.
And that's why the noosphere becomes really fundamental to his overall scheme, because it's the next level of complexified thought. So you're right. Two things he points out: complexity, consciousness. And again, we don't know what consciousness is. We talk about it in terms of subjective experience, et cetera. But scientists talk about consciousness on the level of fundamental particles. Some do. I mean, I think here of the philosopher, the physicist Henry Stapp, or you could think of even Ilya Prigogine, back in, the 80s and 90s, was talking about chemical reactions having some kind of awareness within them, And
you quoted, you quoted in your talk at this conference, Max Planck, who's a very... eminent quantum physicist, saying, quote, "I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as derivative consciousness." And there were a few quantum physicists like Erwin Schrödinger. I don't know that Schrödinger would adopt that exact formulation, but there's a similar, and there's this whole question in quantum physics as to whether the thing that brings about, and most physicists would say the answer is no, but some would say yes, whether the thing that brings about the so-called collapse of the wave function is consciousness, is conscious observation. So anyway,
it's an interesting, go ahead.
Well, let me say one thing, and then don't lose your train of thought. I just wanted to say that the idea that that there is this rise of thought through evolution. Again, there's a purely Darwinian version of this that would depict consciousness as epiphenomenal, which I know you're saying Teilhard didn't, but it's that, if you ask, why did intelligence evolve? Well, it has to do with the virtues of behavioral flexibility, basically. It's like, you know, animal, more and more flexible behavior helps you compete and cooperate sometimes, but do the whatever competition and cooperation helps your genes get into the next generation. That's why insects have such complex behavior and why humans have really, really complex behavior. And, you know, if you ask what it governs super complex behavior, it's what we think of as intelligence. So from a, even if you see the consciousness as merely epiphenomenal and stick to the strictly Darwinian mechanics, you can see evolution as a machine for generating more and more thought. I just wanted to throw that in. And not that Teilhard wasn't at least heavily Darwinian in the way he thought anyway, but that's kind of, maybe we can get to that question, but go ahead and...
Yeah, you put a lot into your thoughts and questions. Yeah, I think going back to, you know, I think the question of quantum reality, you know, I had this this conversation not too long ago with my philosopher friend Jack Caputo, and, you know, he does not want to accept panpsychism per se, you know, and that kind of idea that there's an ontological reality that, you know, is not, that undergirds reality. In other words, that that mind alone is not responsible for the whole of reality, which is a sense what, you know, if mind itself is the determinant of reality, then everything is mind dependent, you know? Mm-hmm. So the question is there an ontological, is there a layer of fundamental reality that has a layer of determinacy in it? You know, is everything indeterminate because it's all relative, it's all mind dependent or observer dependent? I think that question really cannot be adequately answered because truthfully, we would have to get rid of our minds. You cannot get rid of the mind to mm-hmm. answer any of these things. And, you know, that fact alone, whether or not you're a quantum physicist or anything, you know, the fact that mind plays a significant role in anything from, we can't say anything about anything apart from mind, even if we want to talk about the simplest leptons and quarks or whatever, the simplest forms of life. So there's something here that I want to say the Bohr school, the Copenhagen school, you know, mm-hmm. of quantum physics does have a credibility to it. And now there are about 28 different models of quantum physics. And that's, you know, there's probably even more than that. So, you know, not everyone buys into this. But I think, you know, what I like to do, because today we live in such specialized areas of science, every area is just replete with levels and levels of specialization to try to make sense of anything, is to try to step back and begin to see underlying patterns between these various areas. So in one respect, I think the mind-dependent type of quantum reality, where it's observer, it's an observer-dependent universe, which is what Max Planck was holding to. Really, and it's not, and two other thing I want to say here is, I'm not sure I would equate consciousness and intelligence. We might speak about intelligence on, certainly when we get to higher mammalian life, but I think on fundamental levels of life, I take consciousness as really a fundamental flow of information between particles, you know, if I were to put it that way, very, very, very fundamentally, sort of what we might call a wave-wave overlap of information, so that even fundamental particle life can have an informational flow that can give rise to some type of proto-mind, if you want to use that kind of language. But there's something going on here that I think, and why I like panpsychism in this way, is that it gives consistency to the flow of life. And I do look for consistent relationships, that there are not abrupt leaps, although evolution has its, you know, its abrupt cataclysmic changes. But underneath it all, it's like life has 20 amino acids and they haven't changed much, you know, and there's something about life being formed from very simple building blocks into a very elaborate, intricate, you know, systems of life. And I try to look for those kind of simplified building blocks, even in terms of relationships. So I take mind and matter, and it's a choice. I think the other thing here is we make We make a choice based on the knowledge that we know and try to build a paradigm that is most consistent and coherent across the sciences, and then in an even wider framework in my work with religion or spirituality, which is what Teilhard did, actually. He had three laws that governed his way of thinking. One was the law of recurring patterns. He looked for recurring patterns in nature. And then those patterns, as he saw them in nature, increasing over time with evolution through complexity, et cetera, you know, becomes important. The second law is creative union, that something's going on here, he says, that nature, life continues to unify as life develops, you know, through the unfolding space-time. And then three is the law of complexity consciousness, which is what we mentioned, that as, you know, as material evolution complexifies, consciousness seems to rise. And so he places a link between complexity and consciousness. And these three laws actually govern his whole paradigm, you know, barring any kind of spirituality or anything like that, you know, that, and that's, I mean, if we were to think in a Teilhardian sense, it would be in terms of recurring patterns, a creative type of unitive. There's a unitive energy. And that's where he talks about the energy of love, not love as a sentiment or an emotion, but love as a core unitive energy, an energy right. that's binding together in a way that kind of resists entropy, or, you know, is not subject to various physical forces. And this kind of unyielding, or what he calls like an irresistible energy of attraction. So it's very interesting. I mean, you know, people have said he's more poetic than scientific, and, mm-hmm. you know, but you have to I mean, science itself, I think, as technical and as specialized as it can be, it also relies on metaphors and a little bit of poetry at times. It claims, you know, objectivity and exactness, but if you look at the great spans of things, it's not that exact. It's an approximate knowledge of reality, and that's the best we can do. We're constantly approximating what we can say and what we can know about the real. And I think that's how Teilhard, you know, in a sense, approached the whole kit and caboodle here of science and religion.
Yeah. You know, there's a whole controversy over to what extent was he talking about the Darwinian mechanics of natural selection when he talked about evolution. Yes. And he certainly had his kind of eminent scientific defenders, Julian Huxley, the biologist, mm-hmm. Theodosius Dobzhansky, the geneticist. I mean, I don't know whether they'd say that, you know, everything he said was in full compliance with Darwinism or not. I'd also say, you know, his big book, The Phenomenon of Man, there is a lot of what I would call philosophical assertion, conjecture, speculation, but assertion, whatever. Yeah. And I don't think he's always clear in distinguishing between what is a more scientific kind of assertion and a more philosophical kind of assertion. And I think that got him into a certain kind of trouble. I mean, he has this very emphatic way of expressing himself, right? He's a very enthusiastic guy, to judge by his writing. So there's a lot of, and a very poetic writer. So there's, you know, it's easy to dismiss what he's saying as kind of a jumble of kind of mystical, you know, insights or something. I personally just kind of take what I see as being a value. And I do continue to think he was extremely far-seeing and kind of ahead of his time. Now on this love issue, so would you say that in his metaphysics, what we think of as love is kind of a special case of love, and long before there were beings that could reflect and go, oh, this feels like love, there was a force that he calls love that was holding stuff together, maybe holding the universe together. I don't know, right? Is that the idea? Yeah.
It is. Before I get to the love issue, I want to go back to what you were just saying, because three things I just kind of want to put out there. One, you know, Teilhard did not accept Darwin's theory of evolution entirely. In fact, very, very little of it is important to him. He was actually more influenced by the philosopher Henri Bergson and Bergson's notion of creative evolution. There's a dynamic impulse in evolution. And that's very interesting. And I think one of the reasons Teilhard dismissed, he kind of marginalized Darwin was because Darwin did not really adequately provide a role for mind in evolution. It was physical evolution apart from mind. And so that was problematic for Teilhard. So so he does accept the Bergsonian idea of a vital impulse. There's, and that, you know, that can be traced and all the way
Elan, back. Elan vital is the famous kind of French phrase, right?
Exactly. Right, exactly. Second, I agree, you know, the human phenomenon, he says this is a scientific work, but it's got a lot of poetry and diagrams in there that, you know, sometimes do not seem overly scientific. Now, I want to just tell you, I have the 10, I have 10 volumes of Teilhard's science writings. He was an extremely meticulous scientist. As a scientist, he was extremely attentive to the details of his observations and his findings, recording everything in explicit detail. So he was an excellent scientist, actually. Now, why I say that is because I actually think, and I've wondered about this, Teilhard sees a role for science that is, he pushes empirical science. I think we have, certainly in the 20th century, we inherited the modern scientific worldview of empiricism, observation, measurement, you know, adequate theories, the scientific method, et cetera. But we've reduced everything to mere materialism, mere materiality. And what Teilhard is saying, though, there's, yes, matter, fantastic, but there's something to matter that's more than mere matter. And that's why I think he pushes science to say, look, let's back up a little here and let's add another element. And I think scientists are beginning to, you know, it's hard because if you're trained in the sciences, you know, this kind of is like chalk on, you know, it's like nails on the chalkboard. It kind of grinds against you. But I can just speak for myself. I was a scientist originally, and I remember being in a I was at that time measuring single motor neurons using advanced, you know, techniques in electrophysiology. And I remember the first time I recorded one single motor neuron. Now, there are millions of, you know, millions of these things. One, I was just like, I was thrilled. So it wasn't that I stood back in cold objectivity and said, well, here's the amplitude and the oscillating, you know, the oscillating amplitude of this potential and the calcium channel. I mean, I was awed. I was pulled into it. And that's what science does. I think that's what one thing that Teilhard is saying. Science pulls us into the question of matter. We don't, no really engaged scientist just stands back in kind of cold objectivity. A scientist is driven by passion. And that's one thing I think Teilhard introduces into science, even in the human phenomenon. There's something going on here, he's saying, that, yeah, we need to be attentive to what evolution is, but there's something that even sometimes can miss the scientific measurement. And that's what he's trying to get at. So I think he brings passion. He brings the fact that knowledge is it's always approximating the real. And then he introduces now to the question of love, not an emotion. So the love that he's talking about here, and I would trace this love, this kind of unitive energy, in a very Platonic sense, that there is a if it's a, to use your language, if it's a non-zero sum, right, process, it's not using even game theory. Like, it's not just wins and losses. There's a plus one here. For some odd reason, there's a plus one. And that's the question from a Platonic sense. There's a good that supersedes, in a sense, all the negative forces, the entropic forces, however, the resistances. And Teilhard speaks about that plus one goodness, and the highest good is love. That's what love is. Love is the highest good. Whether that goodness is shown in creativity, whether it's shown in compassion, whether it's shown in inventions, it's a good that is always the more of what life is about. And that's what he means, I think, by love. Certainly, it plays out on the human level in terms of the emotional life, in terms of seeing the good in another, of the complementarity of goodness, which is what we mean by falling in love. You know, I mean, there's something about there that, you know, the good within me is complemented or fulfilled by the good in you, you know, and therefore we're going to get married or whatever. So, there, you know, so I think he has a much more robust understanding of love that, you know, goes way beyond our cultural, you know, reductionism of love to this superficial sentiment, which then leads us to realize that Teilhard sees love as the core energy of the universe. It's what's driving everything. There's something going on here that's a good, that's a plus one good, you know. And even though some say, well, the universe is going to reach a point and then start to collapse, you know, which is what the latest theory, that it's all going to kind of wear down and we'll have the last thought in the universe. And I'm saying, well, that's where, you know, that's where science may reach its limits of saying, you know, what is that, this life unto more life? And that's where Teilhard begins to posit another factor going on here, what he calls the Omega Principle. There's something here that's a presence of ultimate goodness or love that is not subject to the forces of evolution, yet it is itself the guiding form of evolution. So this Omega Principle becomes then eventually over time is what he will identify as God, this wholeness of love, or something within this process of life that's kind of, in terms of Bergsonian self, a sense pushing it or pulling it onto something more whole, more life, more complexified, more good, more love, more evil too, because the more love you have, the greater yeah, you know, the more complexity, the greater the chances of evil as well. So you can begin to see how he begins to build his thought, you know, from the elements of evolution, from what he's observing as a scientist, but just saying, look, there's something more that's going on here. He will tell you that science itself is a religion. It's got its own religion to it. You know, the scientist is a spiritual figure in some ways. And yet he wants to broaden that out. And then he wants to, in a sense, see how the elements of, from his perspective, from Christianity, because it's this religion of materiality, you know, saying that God is part of matter. He wants to try to understand how these two things may actually be complementary to each other. And so, yeah, you can, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to see how the elements of his thought begin to work together in a scientific age, you know, without depleting science. In fact, for Teilhard, you can't do religion without first knowing, without attending to science. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Science.
And I mean, Catholicism, more than some evangelical religions, for example, has traditionally been very open to input from the scientific world, and has exhibited less of a sense of threat from, Darwinian, the idea of Darwinian evolution or the idea of evolution than some more conservative Protestant base. Now, you mentioned Omega. You mentioned the Omega point, and you mentioned Omega. You didn't mention the Omega point, but Teilhard is kind of famous for this idea of point Omega, and that very much speaks to our age, because he saw it as something we are heading toward, this big and important point. It reminds me a little of the way some people in Silicon Valley talk about the singularity. And here, you know, we should say, I mean, this is a big kind of like, I guess it's a theological culmination for one thing. It has to do with the further evolution of the noosphere, the further convergence of humankind into, among other things, a kind of something that seems more and more like a single mind. But there is this, there's this spiritual dimension to it. I mean, love, he thinks, is going to play a critical role, or maybe I should say he hopes is going to play a critical role. He was not naively optimistic. I mean, he understood much as we would today that hopes for kind of realizing one world, you know, a true community of peoples, and ultimately even maybe in his theology, something closer to a mind meld, would call for overcoming some real difficulties and conflicts. I mean, he had been an ambulance driver in World War I, and then he lived through World War II. And so he knew, he understood all this. And there's a quote of his I want to read that references the noosphere without mentioning it, and then goes on to get into to kind of define the challenge. He writes, quote, "Humanity is building its composite brain beneath our eyes. May it not be that tomorrow, through the logical and biological deepening of the movement drawing it together, it will find its heart, without which the ultimate wholeness of its powers of unification can never be fully achieved." So he saw the challenge. And am I right to think, you would think that as a Christian, a conventional Christian might be pretty sure about what's going to happen in the end, right? That's what you generally get from Christianity, as I understand it. But was he not quite sure that things would work out well?
Yeah, right. So, you know, Christianity has a narrative, you know, of redemption, eschatology, we're all, you know, going to heaven or something like this. Honestly, I think that's a myth. I think, you know, and I think Teilhard, it's not that he definitely spoke about, you know, using that Christian language of a second coming and this type of thing. But we have to understand, and this is what he's trying to say, we have to understand those mythic elements within the context of science. In other words, you can't just talk about some kind of redemption in heaven or something like this in some kind of detached Platonic way, as if, you know, as if evolution and complexity don't really matter. They do matter. So so what he's saying here, and this becomes very interesting, because he actually brought together mysticism and evolution. And what he's saying, that now on the level of complexified human life, where we are a much higher level of intelligent life, we know that we know, and we do make choices. We make choices against the good, for the selfish self, and et cetera. So he says we have to, in a sense, he doesn't really spell out his mysticism, but he does say it's kind of that sense of mindfulness, or being in touch with one's inner self, in the sense of a Jungian sense. You know, you have to become whole within yourself, the individuated person. You have to kind of reconcile the stuff within you. Evolution is just a way to describe how life keeps complexifying and adapting. But that doesn't negate the fact that we have work to do as human persons. And therefore, Teilhard's saying we have to take responsibility for being in evolution. And that means mm-hmm. we have to take responsibility for you know, being you know, at home in ourselves, becoming more whole within ourselves, whole in the sense of knowing that the intellect alone will not solve our problem, that we do need heart. We need love as compassion. Love is peacemaking. Love is nonviolent. Love is that active resistance. Love is that which confronts those things that want to destroy us or fragment us, and therefore is willing to extend itself, you know, beyond the self towards the other. So that kind of love is very consonant with the Christian message of certainly of Jesus of Nazareth, a higher level of love that goes beyond selfish love, that goes to a kind of selfless love, because I belong to another. That, and we don't, you know, all of this in this respect. Now, Teilhard does not spell this out because, you know, he died. And so you can only do so much in your lifetime. But it does reflect that we have to move. We have the capacity for higher levels of consciousness. I mean, there's, you know, Eastern religions. Now, I would say this is where we need Eastern religions to be part of this conversation. Teilhard, you know, did not spend a lot of time with Eastern religions, and kind of some say he dismissed them. I actually would take a different position there. But, you know, we have the capacity for infinite potential That's what's so amazing about being human. We have the capacity for higher levels of integrated consciousness. But there are so many forces of resistance and detractors, you know, we stay at lower levels of consciousness. Teilhard was pointing in that direction. He realized that we have to, in a sense, continue to go beyond ourselves. He said many, many times, we are not the end. We humans are not the end of biological evolution. We are, in a sense, a species in transition. And this is why he saw the computer or the internet as the next level, which mm-hmm. is what we call today post-human life or transhumanism, even as that movement. It's saying that we're not finished. We're unfinished and that we have the capacity to go beyond. One of the problems today, and Teilhard kind of saw this, that our systems are not aligned with evolution at all. They're working on old fundamental philosophical principles that are now outdated. So we have no systemic support for this kind of overarching evolution that can lead us to a more planetary, what the term that Teilhard used was planetization, a mm-hmm. planetary, or what he called a terrestrial consciousness, a consciousness of belonging to a planet. Now we see this with younger generations with, I think, the continuous use of social media and technology. They are beginning to think differently than older generations. So I think we are already in that process of evolution. We certainly are moving, in my view. And I think Teilhard kind of intuited this because he spoke of a homo progressivus, you know, a progressive human. Mm-hmm. We're moving from homo sapiens to type something like a homo sapien progressivus or a techno sapien of some sort. But we're definitely moving from the species into something new because of basically because of computer technology and the way consciousness itself is really changing today. Mm-hmm. So Teilhard also thought that this omega point that we're talking about is not a point. It's not a point of arrival. It's more like a full flowering of conscious life, what he would call God, or that wholeness, the wholeness of life, fully conscious, fully alive, and you might say fully in the bounds of in the unities of love. Love not as a homogenization, you know. His famous line from The Human Phenomenon is union differentiates. The more we are truly in union with one another, the more we are truly ourselves, since mm-hmm. it's the core of the self that's the basis of union. And what he saw is the full flowering of Omega is actually the richness and robust diversity of all life, plant life, animal life, human life. So he didn't think that it would be really fully achieved here on Earth. He actually, in his final essays, both in Christianity and Evolution and Human Phenomenon, talks about intergalactic life. That what's taking place here, he thought, if these principles, you know, are really scientifically based, and if consciousness is not just a terrestrial phenomenon, but a phenomenon of all life in the universe, wherever life may be, then he saw that the possibilities of extending conscious life into other planetary lives would indeed be the next step. So Omega is not something here. Omega is a cosmic phenomenon. So if you just stretch your imagination, you know, that imagine all possible life forms in the universe coming into a full flowering of conscious life in unity, you know, in union with one another. I see this maybe billions of years into the future. So if we were to ever imagine such a phenomenon, but that's what he, in a sense, in his mind, I think that's the kind of vision he was forming. We're mm-hmm. too small here, entirely too small in our thinking about evolution and artificial intelligence. And I do think some people in Silicon Valley are thinking much more, very creatively in these expansive ways. I think of Martine Rothblatt, for example, and her notion of, you know, brain downloading, which, again, most people just find that very difficult to to take. But what her idea, she's a Teilhardian. Her idea is that consciousness would continue, in a sense, even beyond our physical bodies, you know, so it would be re-embodied in new ways. Consciousness needs some kind of material substrate or some kind of bodily substrate. And so, again, I think Teilhard is somewhat imaginative, but not overly imaginative. I think that some of the stuff that he intuited, he was very, very intuitive. And he intuited some ideas that scientists, both on the part of biological science, but as well as the information sciences, are just beginning to tap into. And it's very, very exciting in my view.
Yeah. So we've been talking about an hour. What we usually do on the podcast is talk for a while the public audience, and then the rest of the conversation is accessible to paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter. Yeah, you've been kind enough to say that you'll stick around for some of that. And so we're going to move to that point. If people want to listen to the rest of this, all they have to do is, Google Non-Zero and Substack and sign up, or failing that, become just an unpaid subscriber, which we also welcome. Or click the link in the show notes or on your podcast app to get there. I want to say one thing I want to talk about in overtime is that, a theme people may have noticed is that I have my way of coming up with a kind of more secular version of kind of what Teilhard was saying and perhaps a less philosophically elaborate version. And I have a version of that for kind of the, what I would call the kind of point omega transition that he sees as calling for a kind of transcendence, a blossoming of love, whatever, if we're going to do it successfully. But with that, I think I want to just quickly, is there any major thing you want to say that for the public audience that you haven't said before we move into overtime? Or are you good? You're ready?
I think we can move in. I mean, I could talk for a long time. So
okay, well, maybe we will in overtime. I'll give you that opportunity. Thanks everybody who has stayed with us for this long. Whether or not you're going to join us for the rest, and now we are moving into overtime.